Welcome to our discussion segment on Confronting Evil. I'm John Streeter.
And I'm Dan Lindsay.
Let's get started. Welcome back to the podcast, Dan. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, my friend. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thank you for sitting in for Joe, who is battling family illness right now. So everybody, he will be back next week for his first episode of the season. But in the meantime, we have the wit and wisdom of Mr. Dan Lindsay here.
So, John, I listened to the episode. Tell me why, because I'm curious, why did you choose the men you chose? Because from what we heard and from what we know of history, two of the three men were not particularly successful in doing what the title of the podcast said in Confronting Evil. So talk to us about that.
It was actually for that very reason. So the genesis of the episode was actually looking at a slightly different time period, still with Buchanan, and then doing Franklin Roosevelt and then Reagan. But I wanted to kind of broaden it out and internationalize it a little bit instead of having it just be an American-centric one. And the idea came to me that Buchanan, he didn't do a good job confronting evil. And then I figured go with somebody that almost everyone, at least who listens to this podcast and fans of, you know, World War II history, they would know, Winston Churchill. No, the guy before him, Neville Chamberlain. And then instead of doing Reagan, I thought, well, why don't we broaden it out to one of the other leaders in the West of the 1980s who helped confront the evil of communism. And I'd recently finished a book on the end of the Cold War by Victor Davis Hanson, and he really emphasized the role of the Catholic Church in pushing back, not necessarily by, as I said in the podcast, leading armies or leading demonstrations or anything like that, but really making a moral case against the evil of the Soviet Union. And I think a lot of times modern societies today think that, you know, either evil is, you know, something of the past, evil is subjective and all of that, or they think evil has to be confronted with force. And sometimes history teaches us that, no, you can actually confront evil with morality. It doesn't have to be Christianity or Buddhism or Islam. It doesn't have to be a religion, but just a common sense of what is right and what is wrong. And I think John Paul II did that in his message of Be Not Afraid.
Well, in all three of those stories, with Neville Chamberlain, with James Buchanan, and with John Paul II, that was a consistent presence in those stories. The moral voice was seemingly there.
Yeah.
So where did Neville Chamberlain and James Buchanan fall short where John Paul II did not?
Buchanan and Chamberlain fell short in different ways. I think that Chamberlain, at some level, certainly after the conquest of Czechia in March of 1939, so about 6 months after the Munich conference where Hitler promised, oh, no more territorial demands, etc., Chamberlain knew, all right, this guy is a moral evil. He is a threat to world peace. He has to be confronted. But his framework for understanding the world omitted the possibility of war, and it omitted the possibility of real and effective preparations for war, as I talked about in the podcast. You know, during those 11 months, there were no preparations for war, no increase in aircraft production, tank production, no increase in recruitment in Britain or France. So Chamberlain thought that words alone would stop Hitler.
Peace in our time.
Exactly. But even after that, the message to Hitler about Poland, the guarantee to Poland, to Hungary, to I think it was Yugoslavia, they were very bellicose. I mean, he was almost Churchillian in his statements about defending Western civilization. The problem is the rhetoric didn't match up with the deeds. And so Chamberlain, I think he misunderstood the nature of the evil that was Adolf Hitler coming out of Berlin that said, I don't care what people say, I'm only going to respond based on what people do. With Buchanan, it was different. Buchanan didn't see slavery as an evil. He was I don't know if he was an ardent supporter of slavery, but and I don't know that he owned slaves. In fact, I think he was from the North. I will be honest, I don't recall off the top of my head where he was from. But he supported the cause of slavery, so he did not see that as an evil. He saw secession as an inconvenience because he understood, you know, the country's breaking up on my watch, and he's hoping that war will not occur until after he is safely out of office and let, you know, it's Lincoln's problem. So his failing in confronting evil was not recognizing it as such. He saw half of the evil of what the South was doing, the much bigger, not half, the much larger evil that they were doing. He didn't see it as an evil. He saw it as a peculiar institution, like a lot of people back then did. And then the political evil of secession, he just is trying to, you know, kind of wave the wolf away from the doors and say, you know, not yet. Wait till I'm gone, and then you can secede and start a war.
Well, and this brings up an interesting question. Would you call James Buchanan and Neville Chamberlain, moral men.
I will confess, I don't know as much about Buchanan in terms of his, like, his moral compass, so I can't speak to that.
But Chamberlain, though.
But Chamberlain, you know, I think he was a moral man. I think he was a decent person. I think he was brought up in a time, he's too old to have fought in World War I, so he doesn't get that very clear definition that a lot of the veterans of that war got in terms of what is good and what is evil, having faced it in the trenches.
And he was still operating under this 19th century aristocratic mentality as well.
Exactly, where he thought that, you know, a gentleman's agreement actually meant something. And it did in Britain at that time, but it didn't to a gangster like Hitler. I mean, Hitler has no concept of keeping his word. And I think Chamberlain was simply unable, like a lot of leaders throughout history, to adjust his understanding of morality to a new amoral world, or at least an amoral situation like the confrontation with Hitler. So, yeah, I don't know if I would call them moral failings on Buchanan's part. Yes, a moral failing in supporting slavery, but not. But it was an inconvenience to him, the whole issue of secession. And as I said, Chamberlain, he couldn't understand who Hitler was until it was too late.
So a question I had as well revolves around the difference between calling an evil and acting in accordance with that conviction. You just mentioned that. What is the difference between the two? And is it important?
Just to clarify, are you talking at an individual level, at a national level, or both? Because I think the answers are slightly different.
Let's start at an individual level.
At an individual level, I think it's important to recognize and to call out evil when you see it. How you approach it is entirely situational. I mean, you know, I've had students who they see somebody being bullied and they go up to the bully and they're like, hey, knock it off. And then I've had students who see, you know, somebody being bullied and they go tell the teacher. They don't confront it themselves. I think it depends on your individual circumstances, your willingness to be confrontational and things like that. But I think it is absolutely necessary for people of good conscience to call out evil whenever they see it. At a national level, certainly you want to call out evil, whether it's in your own country or whether you see it in another country. But it's tough. I had a conversation with Joe about this. You know, when or at what level can people in a democracy affect change if they see an evil? He was bringing up, let's just say for the purposes of making sure we don't get this podcast like banned or demonetized, a recent event in history that was fairly controversial, happened about 4 years ago. And, you know, some of the things that were done by governments around the world were at least morally questionable. Were they evil? There you get into intentions and the fact that we didn't know a lot about that situation. But he said, you know, a lot of people needed to do more. And we were thinking about, like, how much can I do? In the United States, for example, in a nation of 300 million people, we can vote. That's probably the biggest amount of change that we can bring into a given situation. When is it necessary to do more to stand up and be counted as someone who is going to say, I'm going to stop this? I don't know where that line is. I think, again, it's very situational. But I think the willingness to stand up to evil is something that should be encouraged. And that having that mindset is one of the reasons why we're doing this season, is recognizing what evil is so that if it ever becomes necessary, listeners of this podcast and just people more generally who think about the philosophies behind good and evil will have an understanding, okay, this might get to a situation where we have to stand up and do something.
Well, that leads into an interesting question as well. So both Neville Chamberlain and James Buchanan, one could almost make the case that they saw what was going on, but either did not see what was going on as evil enough to act or did not see it as evil. Why could they not have seen what was going to happen down the road? What was preventing them from saying, hey, these are the evils that we are seeing in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what we have seen in the past when such evils go unchecked. This requires action. Why couldn't they not have seen that?
For Buchanan, I think the blinders that he had regarding the evil of slavery that he did not regard as evil, he probably was not able to see that this was going to lead to a conflict until it was too late, until South Carolina had seceded and the other states were in the process of doing so. But in terms of the evil of the coming war, I don't actually blame Buchanan because I don't think anyone was aware or was expecting the Civil War to be as terrible as it was. You got to remember, you probably know this, when you look at the statements coming out of both sides before the first Battle of Bull Run in July 1861, about 3 months into the war, and especially in the run-up to the Battle of Shiloh about 8 months later, everyone thought, short, victorious war. Yeah, some people will get hurt, some people will die. But It's not going to cause 600,000 lives killed. It's not going to change almost a million people's lives forever with injuries and prison and things like that.
Well, and there was history on their side as well. I mean, America is a nation of rebels, right? So,
well, that's true.
Not counting the Revolutionary War, you had the Whiskey Rebellion, you have Bacon's Rebellion, you have all kinds of different uprisings and insurrections that have occurred throughout you know, the early days of the Republic.
And been settled relatively, you know, relatively peacefully, yeah. But they didn't understand the changes in technology versus the changes in tactics. And so the amount of blame that I place, I don't necessarily place a whole lot of blame on Buchanan for not seeing that the war was going to be as bad as it was. It's more about, with him and also with Chamberlain, not taking the actions that could have stopped it. Because Buchanan absolutely could have stopped. Something I didn't quite get into the podcast, was running short on time. The initial seven states that left, when they departed the Union, they did not form the Confederacy immediately. They were seven independent countries. I firmly believe that if Buchanan had declared war immediately and said, no, you cannot leave. The Constitution is a binding document. You don't get to leave just because you don't like the outcome of an election. And had acted militarily very quickly, he would have ended the rebellion very, very quickly. Same thing with Chamberlain. He knew, and we know, that the German generals, many of them, were poised and ready to overthrow Hitler and forestall the coming war if Chamberlain had stood up, specifically at Munich. But Chamberlain, for kind of the same reasons, he was blinded by fear of war. I am not prepared to risk another general European war, as he said it, or as he put it, for a far-off country about which we know nothing. Well, and that's that aristocratic attitude that you brought up, you know, right there again.
Well, and the follow-up question to that is, if James Buchanan would have acted immediately and suppressed the rebellion, or if Neville Chamberlain would have been correct and allowed the German generals to work on overthrowing Hitler, would the world be a better off place? Would chattel slavery in the United States have come to as abrupt of an end as it did? Would World War II have been as comparatively brief as it was?
I mean, that's counterfactual. That's a what-if question. If Joe were here, I would throw a shoe at him. But since you're in the other chair, as a guest, I won't.
I am yet but a novice. So,
the short answer is we can't know. I think the more interesting question you brought up is actually the first one. How would slavery have ended? Because you're right. At that point, there was not a huge abolitionist push for slavery to be abolished nationwide. It's still pockets of abolitionists who are very vocal, but they're not a majority. They don't become a majority until the war makes it very clear exactly what the South is prepared to do to other human beings. So would slavery have ended? I don't know. I do believe that it would have ended during the Second Industrial Revolution, although that was forced upon us much earlier by the Civil War. So you get into a whole series of what if, what if, what ifs. I do think the United States would look very different had the Civil War been a few months instead of 4 years. And with World War II, I mean, you go, again, there's so many different possibilities in terms of, all right, you know, let's say Germany becomes, you know, denazified. Does it restore the monarchy? Does it continue to have this bitterness towards the Allies about Versailles? What do the Soviets do vis-a-vis Eastern Europe? There's so many different, you know, what ifs. But I think in both cases, just in terms of just on paper, the number of lives lost, certainly in the Holocaust, would have been dramatically shortened.
So let's change.
Sorry, the lives would not have been shortened. Just because it would have been a smaller number of people of lives lost. Sorry, that was unclear.
One of the things I learned, well, I guess relearned, is I had forgotten that prior to the South seceding, there was a push for Northern states to secede. That's not something that I think most people realize, that the abolitionists in the North were powerful enough of a force.
They were just loud enough.
Loud enough, yes. Right. But they were loud enough and they were boisterous enough to put together a movement that said, oh, okay, we're going to stand up to this evil and we're going to secede to form a more perfect union.
Yeah.
I found that to be fascinating.
It was a speech by William Seward during the debate over the Great Compromise, which is 10 years before the Civil War in 1850, a compromise that brings California into the Union. Boy, what a mistake that was. I'm just kidding. We love you Californians, but your state is a garbage heap. William Seward, who's one of the, at the time he was, I believe, a Whig, but he became one of the first generation of leading Republicans once the Republican Party formed in 1854, he makes a speech in which he appeals to a higher law. He says, listen, if our Constitution is so broken that it allows people to own other people, then we need to look to a higher law in this country. And what is that higher law? What is the frame in which the document that is our U.S. Constitution sits in? It's the Declaration of Independence. And the Declaration of Independence contains that fundamental value that says we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, et cetera. Everyone knows that part. But then there's a fourth natural right, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it. Seward is making a case that if necessary, we may have to break up this union. The abolitionists hear this, and then in 1857, when we get Dred Scott, they say, okay, the Constitution is broken because the Supreme Court has ruled that slaves can be brought into free territory. That's it. That appeal to a higher law, that's another element of confronting evil, is understanding that, okay, you know, the traditions and institutions of our societies, they can break, but there is still that higher law in which here in the United States, our Constitution operates.
Yeah. Let's change directions and focus on Pope John Paul a second. Here is a man whose life was deeply rooted in conviction, but those convictions led to action. Mm-hmm. And not only did it lead to action in his life, by the record of history, it led to action in the lives of others. You mentioned Lech Wałęsa and the Solidarity Movement, mm-hmm. which was absolutely crucial in the overthrowing of communism in Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
So talk to me about the effect that Pope John Paul II had and what his actions led to and how much of the fall of the USSR can Pope John Paul II take credit for?
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot there. So one of the things I think that sets John Paul II apart from the other two leaders in this podcast is actually the fact that he experienced that evil. If you go back to Buchanan and Chamberlain for just a moment, Buchanan spent most of his professional life as a diplomat. So he was outside the United States, did not see the horrors of the Fugitive Slave Act.
Did not serve in the military or anything.
He may have served in the military as a young man, but he spent most of his career as a diplomat. He was the ambassador to Russia, to Great Britain. That's actually why he was picked in 1856 as a Democratic candidate, was because he was untainted by the issue of slavery. But because of that, he spent so much time abroad, he doesn't see the evil. Chamberlain, privileged, aristocratic, doesn't see the evils of war in World War I, doesn't really understand the gangster, you know, kind of roots of the Third Reich. John Paul II grew up in Nazi-occupied Poland. He spent his early adulthood fleeing Nazi gangs on the streets of Krakow. He spends the first 30 years of his priesthood in communist Poland. So he, with his own eyes, sees evil. And I think that's what really sets him apart from the other two men, is he sees it and realizes it has to be confronted. He understands, as a priest and then as an archbishop and then as a cardinal, he's not going to be able to, again, pick up a gun or lead an army or lead a demonstration in the streets. But he has a very theatrical background. In many ways, he's like Ronald Reagan in terms of his background, not the traditional background. He's Polish, not Italian. He's from a middle-class family. He's not from the elites. Every pope for 500 years had been an elite Italian. And then here comes this Polish son of a laborer who becomes pope. And everyone's just kind of like, really? This is who the church has picked? Reagan in 1980, actor. Yes, he had political experience, but not part of the traditional Washington, New York, California elite. And both with acting backgrounds. Karol Wojtyła, later John Paul II, understood the power of propaganda. He had seen it. He had grown up with it. And he had acted, not in propaganda, but he understood the power of acting and the importance of telling a story. And he wanted his communications about the evils of communism to tell a story. So his homilies, his public statements were always about not communism is evil. He chooses, instead of being so direct, of painting an image of a better world and inspiring people to long for that better world. And that, I think, was way more effective than other reformers who were in behind the Iron Curtain, who would usually be picked up by the KGB or by, you know, the Stasi or one of the other secret police agencies in communist Europe. Because John Paul II is not saying communism is bad, Marx is evil, Marx is a false god, et cetera, et cetera. He's simply saying, open your hearts to Christ.
Well, that was fascinating, too.
And what that brings is an understanding of the importance of human beings. Sorry, I didn't mean to catch you off.
No, that's okay. So the message of John Paul II was an overwhelmingly positive one. It was an encouraging one.
Always.
It's not very often that you see crowds following people in the streets chanting, we want God.
Yeah. Certainly not in a communist country.
No, not even today. Well, we could use a little bit of that today. But I think that's an important distinction You can't fight evil with evil. You can't overcome the darkness with darkness. Mm-hmm. I love the reading that Joe had.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and that brings up an interesting point is there is a role that evil plays. There is a role that darkness plays in the world. Mm-hmm. I'm reminded of the quote where you stare into the abyss until the abyss stares back.
Yep.
And it's almost like you can't know an evil until you stare at it long enough and allow it to stare back at you. Mm-hmm. What role, or I guess even more pointedly, what value does evil play in the world?
Well, kind of like the reading that Joe did during the episode, you can't really understand light unless you have the contrast of dark. And I think that the same is true. You can know what good is, but you don't really appreciate it until you've seen bad. I think of veterans that I've spoken to who served in Vietnam or in, you know, Persian Gulf, and I'm sure you've had the same experience talking to veterans. You know, they knew what good and evil was, but until they've actually been in a war and seen that. One man I knew grew up in Nazi-occupied Poland, about 10 years younger than John Paul II, but lived here in Indiana until he passed away. Same thing. He knew what good and bad was. He knew who God was, but it didn't really become real to him personally, evil and the concept and the importance of standing for good until he saw the Nazis bombing his hometown and carting off Jews to concentration camps. I think the value of studying evil, it's important to understand motivations. It's important to understand patterns, to understand precedents, so that we can appreciate the good that we have. Not to denigrate real problems that do exist, but if we understand the evils of the past, we can appreciate the fact that we're not going through them.
100%. One of the most infuriating things that I've heard multiple times over the last probably decade and a half is that this is the most unjust or hardest time to be alive.
Yeah.
From what perspective are you looking? When you take into account 90-95% of the human population across history lived below the poverty line, yeah. Most people across human history were slaves,
yeah.
Or were indentured or served. They were vassals to a higher state. Mm-hmm. We do have it pretty good.
We do.
So what would you say would be the message to young people today, to people today in general, looking specifically at the lives of James Buchanan, Neville Chamberlain, and John Paul II? What can people learn from them and enact in their own lives?
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I bring
the philosophical
questions. Yeah, we've gone very far from history into philosophy here. This is great. I think first and foremost, and I've told this to students of mine over the years, John Paul's message of be not afraid, I mean, it sounds so trite and so like, oh, that would appear like right next to someone who says like live, laugh, love. And you know, it's that kind of, oh, just be not afraid.
Same words that God said to Joshua.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And that's the key is, okay, I think that be not afraid is so crucial because it asks, why not? And then from be not afraid, you get to, all right, what is the reason for that hope and for that comfort that you have? For religious people, their hope is in God. And it encourages people who don't have any kind of moral compass, any kind of moral understanding beyond just my feelings and my truth, to realize that there are absolutes in this world. I'm not going to preach. I'm not here to, you know, tell anyone what to believe. But there is a source of absolute truth out there. We'd better find out what it is and get to understand it, because that is how you are. That's how you can become not afraid. It's if you understand that, as I said at the end, evil can kill the body, but I think most people out there in the world understand that we are not merely flesh and blood, that there's something else, something deeper. And that message of being not afraid is a reminder that we need to look not just at, you know, our physical comforts and our physical happiness, because there is that kind of inner angst, especially in young people these days. And a message of be not afraid leads to, again, a question of, well, why not? And it leads people to ask questions about, you know, okay, how can I be not afraid? What can I do? And that pushes them towards good, because be not afraid, you know, you're not going to go searching out for evil if you're trying to avoid being afraid.
Right.
It pushes people towards the light, towards the side of the angels, you might say, or the side of good. From a historical perspective, you know, if you look at Buchanan, be very clear on what is good and evil, what is right and wrong. It's very tempting in today's morally relativistic societies, especially here in the United States, to say, well, okay, well, you might think that's bad. That's your truth, but you know, I have my truth. Well, okay. But some things are universally, absolutely, unapologetically evil, and owning other human beings is one of them.
Yes.
I think there are some people today who have the exact same mindset of some of the slave owners. Like, well, that's your opinion. Really? And then when it comes to Chamberlain, I think the message, again, not just to young people, but to everyone, is good is not just words. You can't just say, I'm a good person. You can't just virtue signal, I believe the right things. You have to stand up. And sometimes that's going to cost you something.
Right.
And you have to be willing to make that sacrifice. Chamberlain, through ignorance or through cowardice or through simple age and just
being unwell, he wasn't healthy.
He was not healthy. He had not been diagnosed with the cancer that ultimately killed him. But for whatever reason, he was not willing to make that national sacrifice. Churchill was. There's a lesson in that, that hopefully, you know, we stand up against evil in our personal lives, you know, kids on the playground, people at work seeing, you know, stuff that is illegal or immoral or something bigger in a society. We recognize it early enough that we don't have to stand up and risk everything like the Brits did in World War II and other countries as well. But sometimes that's required. Words are not enough. Evil is not going to be wished away by mere words.
No matter how flowery those words are.
Exactly. Yeah. Chamberlain was a great speaker.
He was.
Yeah.
It's one of the lessons that I've learned in business, because I'm not in the educational sphere on a daily basis outside of
working with my kids. And yeah.
All that.
Yeah. Which is huge.
But in the business
world.
And
they're awesome, by the way.
Thank you very much. Kids, are you listening?
Yeah, there you go.
But from where I sit in the business world, there's a phrase that's going around when it comes to building company culture. And it goes something like, you become what you tolerate.
Oh, yeah.
I think there's a warning in all of this. If you do not stand up in some form, whatever form you're able to do, if you do not stand up and actively confront evil, do you actually believe that the thing you're calling evil is evil? Because
very true.
If you did, you would confront it. And if you don't confront it, you tolerate it. Mm-hmm. And we all know what comes next. What you tolerate, you become.
I would say that's true throughout history, certainly at a personal level and at a social level. I think that's absolutely true. Our society has tolerated so many evils, human society, I mean, not just America, and we've stopped seeing some of those things as evils. That's certainly true.
So on the heels of that, hindsight being 2020, based on these three examples and what you know throughout the remainder of human history, how do we know on an individual level, or how do we know at a societal level, when taking action is appropriate and what the appropriate action is? I know, again, that's a very loaded question.
Yeah.
But how is there a rubric? Is there some kind of process by which we can gauge, okay, enough is enough?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's different for every individual, but.
Yeah, I think to an extent it will be, because it depends on your own moral compass or your own moral beliefs or religious beliefs. I'll give two examples, one individual and one kind of at a social level. On an individual level, I think that, using myself as an example, I would say, stand up and say enough is enough. If my boss or if the government or if someone was trying to get me to violate a core moral or spiritual belief, I think that's the point where I say, nope, not going to happen. I don't care what you do to me. I'm going to fight this. For some people, it will be protecting their families. Do you do what you want to me? Just don't hurt my kids. For some people, it will be don't harm my lifestyle. The motivations will be different, but I think there's definitely a red line that everyone has. At a national level, in a democratic society, I think it should come down to violations of basic rights. But even there, you have degrees of violations.
Right.
Because you have some people who think that, you know, a violation of the right to property is something like taxation. Taxation is theft and things like that. Well, okay, they might want to, you know, take action. I'm not going to. But I think when a government, when a group of people starts pushing against or violating commonly held beliefs in a society, commonly held principles of, like, I don't want to say natural rights, but basic freedoms, basic human freedoms, that is one of the biggest red flags of a rising evil at a national level and at a political level. You go back through history, you look at the Soviets, you look at the Nazis, you look at all of the great evils of the 20th and early 21st centuries. They all have that in common. They have other things in common as well. One of them being a you know, rejection of any sense of the divine and an embrace of scientific atheism. That, well, we'll come to whether that's a sign of evil later in this later in this season. But if you have a group of people, we talked about this, Joe and I talked about this 2 weeks ago in the podcast about Martin Luther. If you have a group of people who are saying, this is the only way you're allowed to think, you're allowed to believe, these are the only circumstances in which you are allowed to speak, this is the only way in which you're allowed to live your life. And if you deviate from that, whether it's the French revolutionaries or the Nazis or the Russians under Vladimir Putin, that is a clear sign of a rising evil. And it's an evil that's not going to stop unless it is challenged. That's, I think, a clear, very clear indicator that something needs to be done.
It's interesting, too, because societies get comfortable. And it's striking to me that in mid-19th century America, most people in the United States were relatively comfortable.
They were.
There was a growing, thriving economy.
Well, white people.
White people,
because I think that's where you're going.
Correct.
Yeah.
And you become blissfully—
Who weren't Irish, I should say.
Yeah, or yeah. But you become blissfully unaware of that which you do not want to pay attention to. Mm-hmm. The same thing happened, I think, in early 20th century, post-World War I. Everyone in Great Britain and in Europe as a whole was like, no, we don't want to even think about war. The Great War was the war to end all wars, yep. And we have to believe that because we're comfortable now. We're still alive. It's almost like you don't want to name the evil lest you give it life.
Yeah.
And so why do societies do that?
That's a really tough question. And another example is after the end of the Cold War. You know, we wished away evil because we beat it, and then we said, okay, yeah, there are no more threats. And then on a bright Tuesday morning in September 2001, we saw evil again. I think part of it is what Norman Angels called the Great Delusion. He wrote a book shortly before World War I, at a time when Europe was at peace and prosperous, at the tail end of the Victorian and Edwardian eras, where, yeah, everyone was very comfortable. And he said, yeah, Europe has lost the psychological impulse to war. When a society has been at peace and has been prosperous, we tend to get comfortable. We tend to invent our traumas. And in a lot of ways, those traumas, real but often exaggerated, they will blind us to the genuine evils and the genuine problems within our society. If you look at the last years of peace before the Civil War, the great national conversation, yeah, it was about slavery, especially after the Fugitive Slave Act and the publishing of Uncle Tom's Cabin and Bleeding Kansas. But almost everyone was talking about the issue of immigration because we had just opened up the West and there was a huge influx of Chinese immigrants. No one was focusing on the genuine evil within the very midst of this country, which is we have redefined what it means to be human. And once government redefines something, it can redefine it again and again and again.
They make themselves out to be God.
Exactly. No one wanted to confront that evil. So we wished it away and we focused on something else. Right before World War I, the great national global conversation was on trade and was on colonialism. No one was talking about the issue of nationalism, the festering issue of nationalism in Eastern Europe, and how that could potentially, that combined with the alliances, could lead to a war. In World War II, as you said, everyone had survived. Everyone who had survived World War I said, we're never doing that again. And so they closed their eyes to a danger. We see it today. There are plenty of evils in our societies, and there are huge numbers of people who simply will not confront them. You have national leaders who are insistent upon starting wars. You have politicians insistent on redefining basic tenets of what it means to be human, basic civil rights in many countries around the world. But because in this historical moment, we're living in a pretty prosperous era, people are more focused on what do they see on their phones. They're more focused on getting more and more of those dopamine hits. They're not thinking about the real evils that exist around us. Not to say that the world is filled with evil, but it exists. Again, it needs to be challenged. And I would make the argument that before you can challenge it, you have to know it. You have to recognize that it exists. John Paul II gave us a great way of recognizing that. If you see a society, if you see a government, if you see a group of people who are ignoring, who are rejecting basic tenets of freedom and humanity. Not a political statement, just a fundamental issue of you are a unique creature created in the image of God. If there's a society that denies that and says, no, you're a cog in a wheel, that right there is dangerous. You will be tempted to be afraid of that, But you should not be afraid. You should embrace what societies throughout human history have taught you, that you are that unique creature made in the image of God, and reject the scientific atheism and the political tyranny and the distortion of facts and truth and biological realities. Ignore all that. No, you need to stand up for what you know is right. Well, thank you, Dan. I appreciate you joining us. This has been great.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Yeah. Joe, feel better, all right?
Joe, feel better, I suppose. No.
or not.
You know. No, we want you back. And your family as well. Hopefully Sarah and the kids are feeling better. And thank you, audience, for joining us in this discussion of Confronting Evil. I'm John Streeter.
And I'm Dan Lindsay.
Be sure to leave us a review wherever you listen to this podcast. It really does help. Thanks, and we will see you next week.